And Jesus was transfigured. He went up into the living presence of God, and that bright cloud descended upon him, and he became bright. But John, who was with him, was transformed. Jesus was transfigured as he went up into the living presence of God, and there was the presence of Moses and Elijah, the two most important figures in his faith. But James was transformed. Jesus was transfigured as even his appearance, but his head and his heart were changed inside of that moment, and that voice came from the cloud, "This is my son whom I love. Listen to him." But Peter was transformed. Jesus was transfigured, but the disciples were not. They were transformed. That moment was absolutely a changing moment. Can you imagine having been present at that moment? Can you imagine how it would change you? What an amazing thing, what an incredible thing to be able to say, "This is what I saw." If you were there, how would you react? I have no idea how I would react, but let me tell you how Peter reacted. Peter was the kind of guy, he was always one who spoke first and engaged his brain later. And Peter said to Jesus, "Oh, Lord, it's such a good thing that we are here. You know what? For you three, for Moses, Jesus, and Elijah, I can put up a tent for you." What? It's helpful if we go into other translations. In other translations, it will say, I could build for each of you a tent, a shelter, a booth. But now listen to this one, a memorial. Ah, even in that moment, Peter understood that Moses and Elijah and Jesus did not need a tent to stay in. They didn't need that at all. What Peter was asking was, "Oh my gosh, this is such an amazing moment. We should remember this. We should build a monument. We should build a memorial." And Jesus said, no. Stop. And on the way down the mountain, Jesus actually said to them, "Now, do not speak of this to anyone. Not until everything has played out. Not until you look backwards are you allowed to tell this story." So then why were Peter, James, and John there? There was nothing that they could do. Jesus did not bring them there because he needed some extra hands to put up to pitch a tent or to build a shelter or put up a booth or erect a memorial. No. He was not there for the disciples to do anything. Why then? Peter, James, and John were there as witnesses. Witnesses. Here's the deal. We have to be able to have that which is on the outside function the same way as what's going on the inside. And this is where we're going to be going and exploring in your life. In order to get there, I need to show you my brother Bruce's car. My brother Bruce was 16. The ink was not even dry on his driver's license when he found the car of his dreams. Well, at least that's what he thought. It was a 1958 green and white Chevy Biscayne, four-door. Somehow, some way, my dad found this. It was in a barn, in the lean-to on the barn, a mile south of town. It had been in that barn for at least 15 years? I don't even know. Way over a decade, the tires were flat and it was covered with grime, dust, dirt, and bird poop. And my brother looked at that bird poop covered car and said, "Oh, yeah, that one." And so what they did, he actually paid $100 for this car. My dad and he went out into the barn, they jacked it up, put it on blocks, took all four wheels off, put them in the back of the van, took them down to Dienstlich's repair shop, and at Dienstlich's they gave him brand new, well, brand new bad tires, okay? It was as used as they could that would still hold air. And they put four brand new tires that would actually support the weight of the car, and they towed that car all the way back to my backyard. Oh, was my mother excited about that one? And they started to work on it, and my brother got the hose out. You'll see all the muck and junk on the front of the grill on this one. And oh, show him the trunk. And my brother scrubbed that car and vacuumed that car, and they worked on the engine, and my dad and my brother spent hours and hours and hundreds of dollars trying to get this car to run. They dropped a brand new battery, and yes, the radio worked. It took them about a year and a half of backyard shade tree mechanicism to discover that this car was never going to start. Engine block was cracked. And it was about a year and a half that my mother said, "It's not going to start, get it out of here." But this was my brother's car. Well, actually, I don't know, can you qualify it as a car? Because here's the deal, on the outside it looked like a car, and my brother had it clean and shiny, it was beautiful. There is no rust on it. But inside, it's not a car. The outside and the inside don't match. On the outside, it looks like what it's supposed to be, but the inside, it does not run. The inside and the outside, no, they didn't match. This is exactly what was happening with Peter up on the mountain. The outside and the inside didn't work together. And Peter said to Jesus, I'll help, I'll put up a memorial, I'll build it for you. And Jesus said, no, sit down. Why was Jesus bringing James, Peter, and John? He needed them to be witnesses. He did not need them to do anything. He needed them to be witnesses. Oh, I had a friend, her name was Sis. Sis fell. Her real name was Lillian, but everybody for decades had called her Sis. Sis had been raised on a farm in North Dakota, to the southeast of Bismarck, down by the town of Hazleton. And as she was raised in that family, out on that sweeping North Dakota prairie, she was the oldest of three sisters, and then a few years later, there was a youngest brother. Her father was a heavy alcoholic, and even worse than that, he was a mean drunk. He wasn't drunk all the time. The majority of time he was sober, but boy, I tell you what, when he had to go into town, he was a mean drunk. And you better believe that this affected Sis in powerful ways, because what it meant was that she wasn't just the oldest sister. No. In effect, she became the oldest brother. That her dad worked her harder than any field hand. And this is what it meant, and this is what it took to keep that farm surviving. And in the heart of the Great Depression, Sis turned 20. She had been born in 1912, and so it was in late 1932 that she turned 20, and she was still single. Well, she was out one day on, it was a very specific date, December 20th. 1932. And on that day, she and her sister were in the buckboard. The family, this was the heart of the Depression. They had no car. Her dad was a horse farmer. They did everything by horse, even into the 30s. She was out with her sister on the buckboard checking cattle. They had to check the fence lines because the snow would fall, but then the snow would blow. Welcome to North Dakota. And as it would blow, the snow would get caught on the fence lines, and the fence lines would drift over. You know how hard that drifted snow is, and the cattle could walk right over. And it would take them months to find the rest of their cattle. So Sis and her sister were regularly out and checking the fence lines. Well, one day, December 20th, beautiful sunny afternoon, they were sitting in the buckboard on top of a rise, just looking out over the valley below, when from the other direction came a guy on horseback. He saw them, they saw him. It was this handsome young guy. They recognized him. They knew him, you know, they knew of him. His name was Quentin. And Quentin was in his late 20s. He had just started farming. His parents had been farming, and now he was making a break for it. He was trying to become independent and had his own place, really, really bare bones. It was basically a homesteading shack that he lived in. And on that day, he rode up, cowboy hat and strong young man. Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you, in Sis's eyes, he was a sight for sore eyes. He was gorgeous, and that's what he thought about her. So they talked and talked and talked and talked for about an hour, and finally, Sis's sister said, "We got to go. Before sun falls, we got to go." They agreed to meet 3 days later. There was going to be a community dance out to the east of Hazleton in one of the community dance halls that just sat out on the prairie. And so 3 days later, they met up. They came early. They had supper together. They spent the entire evening in that dance hall, danced every dance together. And when the band quit playing around midnight or 1 o'clock, those two still kept dancing. And they talked into the dark hours of the morning, finally going home exhausting because somebody had to go and do chores. But they agreed that they would meet again. They agreed that 1 week later, on December 30th, that they would get together again. And so Quentin borrowed a car. He grabbed a couple of his friends, and they went on a double date. He drove down to her place. She met him at the door in her best dress. And her mother kissed her on the way out, and they got in the car, and they drove 22 miles to the northeast to the preacher's house. And the pastor welcomed them into his living room, and Mrs. Pastor was there. She played the piano and had baked a cake because she knew they were coming, and those two got married. They had known each other 10 days. Their wedding was the third time they had talked to each other. All right, here's your question. Were you paying attention? How many people were in the room? You know, you would think it was four. There was Pastor and Mrs. Pastor, Quentin and Sis. No. There were six. Those two friends of Quentin's were the best man and maid of honor. And they stood. Now, let me ask you this. What was their job? Their job on that day was not to do anything. They were there as witnesses. And Sis and Quentin could not have been married if those two had not been present. They were not supposed to do anything. Just be. Be present. Be there. Be listening. Be watching. Be witnesses. Being a witness is incredibly important. My friends, this is what I'm asking you to do this morning. Those discipleship pathway assessments are helping me because I need a witness to what is happening in our church. Do you ever think about a pastor's job description? A pastor's job description is really pretty crazy because on the one hand, I'm supposed to be in my office 24 hours a day, and on the other hand, I'm supposed to be out visiting 24 hours a day. I'm supposed to be in the hospital, in the homes, in the nursing care, in nursing homes, in the care centers. At the same time, I'm supposed to be preparing for sermons, and then I have to, I work on all of the administrative and the prep work for it, and I'm out and preparing the sermons, and then actually preaching the sermons, and so much more. Now, if you were a pastor, oh, and by the way, that's one of the reasons why I love being a pastor. I never have 2 days the same. And it's an amazing thing, the way that I get to interact with people. I love it. But now stop and think, how does a pastor know how to guide a congregation? Today, what I'm asking is for you to be a witness. Would you help me? Would you help me know how to guide this congregation? The information that you're giving me is unbelievably important because what I simply need is not for you to do anything in this moment. Just be a witness and share with me what you see. Share with me what you hear. Share with me where you are. That's what we need. Oh, but now let me take this another step further. I want to invite you to be a witness in your own life. How many of us in the American culture, how many of us think that what we have to do is busy, be busy, 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 busy? If I can quote one of the great wise men of our time, Mr. Arnie Koski. Arnie has told me many times, oh, I never should have retired. At least back when I was working, I had a day off. When we are in American culture, we are busy people. And that's a wonderful thing. It can be very positive and proactive. But what happens when we get to be too busy? There comes a time when God says to us, stop. In the same way that he said to Peter, stop. No, no. I don't need you to do anything. I just need you to sit. I just need you to be. God is calling us at times to jump into action and to be God's hands and feet. But there are other moments when God says, no. No, that's not what I need. I need you to sit. All right. Let me give you one more story to show you what I mean. Do you think we're at a point where they can come help me? Okay. I'm going to need one person to sit in a wheelchair. Who do you think that should be? Can you help me find that person? And you guys can come up and be with me here. When I was a brand new pastor, a friend of mine introduced me to the nursing home. And up in the nursing home on that day, he introduced me to one of the people who would become unbelievably important in my life, Grandma Teaslink. Grandma Teaslink was in a wheelchair. Oh, would one of you like to sit in my wheelchair? Now, I got to warn you. Oh, you want to try it? Come on, Theo. All right. Now, what I got to warn you, Theo, is you just have to sit still. Can you do it? Okay. When I met Grandma Teaslink, she was sitting in the wheelchair. Let me tell you about Grandma Teaslink. At this moment, she was right around 88 years old. It had been 50 years earlier, when she was in her late 30s, that her husband had died. Oh, my goodness. How many children do you think Grandma Teaslink had? Yeah. I'll tell you. Nine. She had nine children. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine what would happen if there were nine children in your family and your dad died? Well, that was exactly what happened to Grandma. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. It was exactly what happened to Grandma. And she had to figure out how to live life all over again. She had to figure out how to go out and get a job. She had to figure out how to let her children work. And she had to have the older children raise the younger children. And together, the whole community wrapped their arms around them and said, you are part of us. And she did it. And she was such an amazing part of that church, an amazing part of that community. But then, when she was in her early to mid-80s, Grandma Teaslink had a stroke. Now, you know what a stroke is, but the kids don't. All right. Nathan, let me tell you and teach you what a stroke is. A stroke happens when there is a blood vessel, a blood clot in your brain, and it makes your brain malfunction, and then it makes your body malfunction. Grandma Teaslink in her stroke lost, are you ready for this? All right, she lost the entire right side of her body. Her feet, she could not walk anymore because she could not move her right foot or her right leg. She could not write anymore because she could not move her right arm and right hand. She could not speak anymore because that part of her language disappeared. The only thing that Grandma Teaslink could say was one-syllable words. She could say, yeah, no, That was about it. But there was one thing that Grandma Teaslink was an amazing person for. She could pray. Not out loud. She could pray in her heart where God could hear. And so what I discovered very, very early, Theo, was that when I would go, when I would get in trouble as a pastor and I didn't know what to do and I didn't know who to talk to, I would go talk to Grandma Teaslink. And I would say to her, I'm in trouble. Would you pray for me? And she would look at me and say, yeah. And she would pray. All right, that's what I needed you for. Okay, thank you for that. And now I'll send you back to the table, and then I'll finish. Ready, set, go. it was an amazing thing when I got to interact with Grandma Teasling, because in her life she had been so incredibly busy, and then with no warning whatsoever, all of a sudden she absolutely could do nothing and had to have help with everything. Emily, are you helping me? When I would go to Grandma Teasling and I would say, Grandma, can you just pray for me? The look in her eyes was so priceless, because for years now she had been told, no, you can't do anything. And God said, I just need you to be. And I stepped into that knowing that that was the number one strength that she had. When I would leave that nursing home and I would know that Grandma Teasling was praying for me, let me tell you, I was wrapped in God's loving embrace, because I knew that she was praying her heart out for me. God used her stillness. This is what I'm inviting you to do. What I'm inviting you is to make sure that the outside matches the inside, like a junky car that doesn't run. This is how we are. And what I want is for the outside to be matching the inside. I want the outside to be healthy and strong, and the inside to be healthy and strong. But so often we just go, 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 do, work, work, work. Meanwhile, we're nothing but an empty shell. Stop. There's a time when God calls us into action, and there's a time when God says, sit down, be quiet. Just be. When I was with Grandma Teasling, I was with a witness. I was with a woman who knew what it meant to live every moment of her life in God's grace. Even after the stroke, she knew, and she was. This is what I celebrate, is the fact that God has called us into moments when we're in action and moments when we are just still. And God is present in both of them. May it be this week that God calls you into moments of action, but God calls you into moments of stillness, so that your outside can match your inside. When we give everything we have to God, a lot of times it doesn't mean that we give all of our action. It means that we give all of our stillness also. I invite you to be quiet this week, so that your inside can match your outside, and your outside can match your inside. In Jesus' name, amen. Would you pray with me? Lord, we give you thanks for all the ways in which you invite us. May it be that you are constantly, constantly reminding us to be the people that you created us to be. Inside, outside, outside, inside.